Welcome to Talk Theater in Chicago, the podcast. Brought to you by TalkTheaterInChicago.com.
Hello, hello, and hello, and welcome to another enrapturing episode of Talk Theater in Chicago, the podcast. Brought to you by TalkTheaterInChicago.com. Coming up on today's podcast, we have two interviews ready for your listening ears. Our first interview is with Raymond Fox from Looking Glass's Old Curiosity Shop. Also, we have from Strange Tree Group's Funeral Wedding, Matthew Holtzfiend, and playwright Emily Schwartz. Also, Chicago critic Tom Williams will be bringing us two more audio reviews, and of course, as always, Chicago's theater news. So sit back, relax, and get ready to talk some theater. Hello, and welcome to Talk Theater in Chicago's news podcast. I'm your host, Dustin Mote, bringing you the theater news for the week of May 22nd, 2006. The Chicago Shakespeare Theater's 20th anniversary season will be aptly inaugurated with a transatlantic production of Henry IV, Part 1 and 2. The show is currently running at the Shakes through June 18th, and the show will be concluding at Shakespeare's birthplace, Stratford-upon-Avon, in England at the Royal Shakespeare Company from July 6th through July 15th. Henry IV, directed by Chicago Shakespeare Theatre Artistic Director Barbara Gaines, will mark the debut of Chicago Shakespeare Theatre with the Royal Shakespeare Company in England. It is a part of the historic first-ever RSC Complete Works Festival, a year-long celebration presenting the entire Shakespeare canon. Chicago Shakespeare Theatre is one of only three U.S. companies invited to perform at the festival. Congratulations, Barbara Gaines and the Chicago Shakespeare Theater. Don't forget the celebrations this week surrounding the reopening of the LaSalle Bank Theater. Remember, on Tuesday, May 23rd at 8:30 at night will be the official lighting of the marquee. A special guest will be flipping the switch. And then this Wednesday, May 24th at 7:30 will be the inaugural performance starring Michael Crawford. Don't miss these major events happening this week at the LaSalle Bank Theater. This is going to be one exciting and historic week for the LaSalle Bank Theater. Don't miss it. Well, just a little bit of New York news for you. The Tony Award nominations have been announced, and it seems that The Color Purple has garnered about 11 nominations. You may remember that show as being directed by Chicago's own Gary Griffin. That's right. Well, to find out who exactly is going to win the award, you are going to have to tune in on June 11th for the CBS broadcast to see who exactly won from The Color Purple. Until then, if you see Oprah on the street, go ahead and congratulate her. She's doing quite a bit for Chicago theater. The historic Chicago theater will be opening up its basement theater on July 11th. The new 250-seat house will be opening with a two-man off-Broadway musical called The Big Bang. Remember, the show runs from July 11th through August 20th. Don't miss it. This is just a little announcement reminding you that the Remy Bumpo Theater Company and their production of Power has been extended at the Victory Gardens Theater. The show will now close on June 11th. You have more of an opportunity now to see the show. Don't miss it. And Talk Theater in Chicago would like to congratulate playwright Nick Patrica, who won the Dublin International Gay Theater Festival's Oscar Wilde Award. Nick won the award for outstanding achievement in new theatrical writing. Chicago playwrights are making a stronger stance internationally, and we couldn't be prouder. Congratulations, Nick Patrica. Well, thank you for listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's news podcast. Remember, we are here every week to give you Chicago's theater news. So until next week, I'm your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you that theater's happening. Don't miss it.
This is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's review podcast. Here is my review of The Old Curiosity Shop. The Old Curiosity Shop, a Victorian fairy tale of joy and woe by Charles Dickens, a stage play conceived by Raymond Fox, adapted by Raymond Fox with Laura Eason and Heidi Stillman, directed by Tracy Walsh. Enchanting Dickens' fairy tale comes to life at Looking Glass Theater. No one adapts Charles Dickens' novels as wonderfully as Looking Glass Theater Company. Their version of Hard Times a couple of years ago was splendid and spectacular. Their present Dickens work, The Old Curiosity Shop, is a sensual triumph with exquisite lighting by T.J. Gerskin, sets by Brian Sidney Bembridge, and costumes by Maria Blumfield. These elements propel us back into the Victorian England of the 1830s. The Old Curiosity Shop is an adult fairy tale of dark despair that moralizes on the evils of gambling, greed, and human frailty, filled with Dickens' most bizarre characters and his most delicious villain, Mr. Quillip, played by Thomas J. Cox at his bow-legged, manically nasty best. This is an early Dickens novel that isn't as complex in many ways as his later ones, but it still plays out to be quite interesting. The show is narrated by Raymond Fox as the single gentleman. The play is set in a curiosity shop, which is an establishment where one could purchase secondhand goods of antique type and, of course, junk. Little Nell, played by Laurie Hamm, tries to help her grandfather, Troy West, run the shop, but his gambling addiction overwhelms him and he loses his shop to Quillip. Nell and grandfather are forced to journey from London to avoid Quip's wicked avarice and debtor's prison. Their travels through the English countryside lead them to meet a host of characters, some evil, some good, but all are vibrantly interesting. The fate of Nell is vividly played out with a wonderful, quick-paced production filled with unpredictable twists and marvelously developed little anecdotal characters. This adaptation takes a long, often rambling and quite sentimental novel and trims it down to 2.5 hours of Victorian adventure filled with humorous characters and telling morality. What makes this tale work is the empathy evoked by Troy West's grandfather and the innocence of the devoted little Nell, played with strength by Laurie Hamm. When you add Thomas J. Cox's terrific turn as the bow-legged, richly evil Quillip, who has almost mythological appeal, and the outstanding ensemble work from the likes of Eva Brenneman, Lawrence DeStacy, Raymond Fox, Tony Hernandez, Lisa Trujillo, and Andrew White, each playing multiple characters, and The Old Curiosity Shop unfolds as a marvelously engaging night of theater. The stellar use of Bembridge's two-tier set, complete with the centered arc bridge, and the vivid use of background lighting illustrate the show and adds depth to the story. The complex story is easy to follow as director Tracy Walsh has each character played to the hilt to garner laughs and exaggerate the bizarreness of their human traits. This ambitious production contains a tad too much, but then Dickens' stories are so dense that they require many scenes filled with wacky personalities. Looking Glass's production is clever, enchanting, and a thoroughly entertaining show that offers a flavor of Dickens' time and his understanding of the human spirit. My rating for this show is recommended. It is at Looking Glass Theater, 821 North Michigan Avenue in the Water Tower Pumping Station in Chicago. The tickets are $20 to $58. The running time is 2 hours and 30 minutes with intermission. It runs through June 11th. For more information, call 312-337-0665. That's 312-337-0665. This is Tom Williams reminding you, go see a play this week. Hello, this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's Review Podcast. Here's my review of Funeral Wedding, the Alvin play. Funeral Wedding, the Alvin play by Emily Schwartz, directed by Kirsten Brookman and Jesse Geiger, produced by Scott Dre and the Strange Tree Group. Another twisted play from the talented, wacky playwright Emily Schwartz. In 2004, I saw Emily Schwartz's The Dastardly Ficus and Other Comedic Tales of Woe and Misery. I loved her blend of humor with the macabre and her silliness with her richly developed wacky characters. She spins an unpredictable storyline that produces mysterious elements within her unique plots. Schwartz is a talented playwright. She's back again with another weird, funny, yet dark unromance that is part murder mystery, part psychosexually repressed people with deliciously disturbing characters. This is a smart work that you'll enjoy. Funeral Wedding, the Alvin play, is a Victorian Gothic-style dark comedy set in pre-World War I America about an oddly dysfunctional family. We meet Alvin in a terrific performance by Matthew Holsfein, who is the self-confined in his two-room attic space for the last several years. Alan has emotional problems, making him neurotic, emotionally spent, and guilt-ridden. Holsfein talks directly to the audience, no fourth wall here, as he connects to us about his life, his family, his problems. Alvin is so empathetic that we quickly like him. His family has a weak father, played by Ira Amix, a demanding and overwhelming mother, played by Jennifer Marchand, and a social climbing sister named Anne, who's played by Carol Ennick, who Alvin admits he has had a lust after in a dream. Kind of likes his sister. Alvin has a secret he is unable to articulate that renders him dysfunctional and a recluse. He witnessed the murder of two young girls, yet he refuses to either acknowledge nor talk of the event. He is on heavy medication while he struggles with his trauma. Who is the murderer? He fears the family doctor, played by Les Krauss, and we learn that the evil commanding physician lusts after Alan as well as his sister Anne. The show takes place in Alvin's messy bedroom, which is a nice set by Chris Steingrevix. The set also contains a mute vaudevillian musician, played by Scott Cooper, who underscores the action with his sound effects and his occasional blowing of the French horn. He also uses Victorian-style posters to sort of cue up the next scene. This is a nice little touch. Alvin is visited by the ghosts of the two slain girls who haunt him into revealing their fate. Will Alvin be able to handle the restless pounding from his sister and father to leave the room and rejoin society? He gets prodded very hard by these folks. When Anne announces she's going to marry the doctor, Alvin becomes distraught. Without giving away key plot elements, let me state that this play contains many funny moments and clever twists that play out deliciously and unpredictably. Filled with much repressed sexual fantasy and twisted characterizations, Funeral Wedding is refreshingly different in structure and in content. I like the smart use of rhyme to announce the doctor's alibi. Having Anne also answer him in rhyme was pleasing and intelligent. The play could use some tightening and some cuts, but ultimately it delivers a strange, intoxicatingly likable, and thoroughly entertaining show. It evokes Edward Gorey, Tim Burton, and Charles Adams. Yet, Emily Schwartz is a new voice who can combine humor and the macabre in an interesting style. Matthew Holsfein's performance was amazingly human, funny, and compelling. Catch this little gem to discover excellent Chicago storefront theater at its best. My rating for this show? Highly recommended. It is at the Athenaeum Theater, which is at 2936 North Southport in Chicago. Tickets range from $12 to $15. And folks, I can tell you, this is a bargain. The running time is 2 hours, 30 minutes with intermission. It runs through June 17th. For more information, call 312-935-6860. That's 312-935-6860. This is Tom Williams reminding you, go see a play this week.
Thank you. to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. This is Tom Williams. My guest today is from the company of Looking Glass Theater, who has recently mounted The Old Curiosity Shop by Charles Dickens, which is a terrific play. And our guest today, Raymond Fox, wears several hats in the show. Hello, Raymond.
Hello.
How you doing today?
I'm all right. How are you?
The show is great.
Oh, thank you.
And tell us about how you got involved, because besides being one of the stars of the play, you are the person that came up with the concept and were one of the adapters.
Yes, I and Laura Eason and Heidi Stillman, who are fellow ensemble members, worked on the final script, and I was the person who first came to the company with the idea of adapting the novel into a play. And then shortly thereafter worked with the director, Tracy Walsh, on the project.
What got you interested in doing the Old Curiosity Shop?
Well, as ensemble members at Looking Glass, even those of us who are not, most of us came to the company primarily as actors, but we're all encouraged to contribute as creators as well. We do almost entirely world premieres in the company, and the vast majority of those premieres are generated from within the company itself, either as original plays or adaptations of works from other sources. And Heidi Stillman had done a production, a very successful production of Hard Time, and I had worked on that show as an actor. And Dickens has always been my favorite author since I was in high school, and I think I've read all of his books but one. I'm saving one. All of his novels, and I thought that his work was particularly suited to Looking Glass because of its scope and so many characters and the themes he addresses. And so I had approached Heidi with specifically the idea of the Old Curiosity Shop in mind, because Hard Times, as you may remember, used a lot of circus, literally and metaphorically, to tell the story, which is something that a lot of members of our company have advanced skills in that regard. And the Old Curiosity Shop, although there isn't a formal circus in the production, there's a waxworks show, and there are giants and dwarves and a Punch and Judy proprietors who come through the narrative, and it's very, very imaginative in that way. Many, many, many characters, and it also has this weird sort of almost fantasy backdrop to the story of this young girl and all the characters she meets. It's almost as though if Dickens had written The Wizard of Oz, this would be the closest thing to that. And so I thought that that would appeal to the company. So I approached Heidi, and she was busy working on other projects at the time, but she was very excited about the book. And I was working on a play in New York and had a lot of extra time, and so I thought, well, I'll take a stab at this. And then that was now 4.5 years ago. And so that's how it started. And Tracy Walsh, who she and I had encountered the book ourselves about together 18 years ago, we took a course on Dickens at Northwestern when we were seniors as undergrads. And she and I and Laura Eason was also in that class. And The Old Curiosity Shop was among the books that we read. And Tracy had actually written in the margins of her copy, this would make a great play. So it was something that from that standpoint, I think had a long kind of genesis in the back of all of our minds. So that's how it began.
That's a heck of a story. And that teacher should be proud of doing a good job on Dickens.
Yes,
he certainly got you guys into
it. Herbert. I think he might still, I'm not sure if he's still teaching at Northwestern or not, but it was a great course, and we all just loved that book so much.
So you were one of the you got this thing started, and you did a lot of the writing.
Yes, I did the very first draft on my own, which was very, very long. We originally had envisioned it being two plays. And that's how it remained in development for the first few years. So I did a first draft that was never meant to be something that would be performed, but just taking out anything that I thought could conceivably work on stage with, you know, 11 or 12 actors playing multiple roles.
I think there's something to having an actor of your experience doing an adaptation, because it certainly was so organized with all the characters that were going on. It was a very easy play to follow.
Oh, that's great.
And I'll tell you what, I could just see a play like this getting so complicated that you would just lose the audience, but not the way you guys presented it. So I think it has a lot to do with that ensemble where you guys are all, everybody's involved in everything.
Yes, and that, you know, and in terms of the other creators, they were, you know, it really is a group effort. Again, Laura Eason and Heidi Stillman were able to go through with the final draft and see places where we could remove three additional characters that, you know, were, although they were great, it just would have made that very even more confusing. And they were very creative in terms of altering some of the novel's trajectory and changing the relationships of some of the characters from what they are in the book so that we could do it with a smaller number of characters. But even so, I think we have 27 or 28 speaking characters that appear maybe in the show.
Yeah, it's got to be at least that many.
Actors.
Yeah, and there's only 10 actors. Wow.
Right.
Well, who came up with the set? Because I love the way it was backlit and the long set with the arch that's like a bridge and, you know, it's a couple levels. I thought that worked very, very well.
Yes, Brian Sidney Bembridge, who's one of he's a Looking Glass associate as well. He designed the set and he also did the lights for Hard Times. So he'd worked, of course, with the company on a number of productions, but specifically on Dickens with us before. And so he designed the set in consultation with Tracy. She had a basic idea, and then the two of them worked over about a year, I guess, to figure out what would be the best environment that could be so many different locations and that would hopefully thematically capture the scope of the play. And they also decided on what configuration the theater would be in and all of that. And then T.J. Gerkins, who is a lighting designer who often works with Mary Zimmerman, Tracy and I know, we had him come in from Cincinnati to do the lighting design, and Mara Blumenfeld, the fellow ensemble member, did all the amazing costumes, and many of those she designed from the ground up, which was just extraordinary. Three of those designers, we just got the best people we possibly could, and we're so grateful for that.
Well, you know, when you had the way some of those still shots went well with the people up on the bridge, and it reminded me of the illustrations that were usually in the Dickens novels.
Yes.
And that was such a clever and effective way of bringing us, engaging us. Anyone who's read Dickens who saw those illustrations, as soon as they see that, it instantly draws you into the show.
Oh, that's exactly what Tracy wanted to do, and that was all her vision, getting all that up there. And it is just, I'm unfortunately on stage when a lot of that's happening, but I have ducked out a few times, stood back and...
And Thomas Cox is as the villain with the bow-legged bit. I mean, that is amazing.
He's just, yes, he's really the only one we thought of that could do that part, and he's so perfect, and we're just so glad. We're so glad for all of the actors that we have in the show.
Yeah, name some of them. I liked the girl that played Nell.
Yes, Laurie Hamm, who is somewhat new to Chicago. She's lived here for a year or two, but I think this is her first sort of... production that she's done with a large theater company, and that was the thing that we had the most concern about, was finding someone to play that role that you could that you would really feel something for. On the page, the character is so idealized and so sentimentalized, and we just wanted it to be, you know, this young girl who is there to help her grandfather, and that people could hopefully identify with and just be a kind, good, capable person. And Laurie really came in to the audition, and within about a minute, she just sort of lit up the room, but she felt like she had some backbone, too.
Oh, yeah, she's got a little feistiness to her, which helps, yes.
And yes, which we felt we really needed, especially with a show that's under 2.5 hours.
Yeah, give us a little quick plot summary for those listeners who don't know the show.
Yes. Well, in the novel and in the show, it's the story of a young girl, Nell Trent, who lives with her grandfather in a sort of a rundown curiosity shop in London in 1839-1840. And her grandfather is her sole caretaker. And a curiosity shop is sort of a cross between an antique shop and a junk shop. And Nell is on some mysterious errand in the middle of the night, late in the evening, and she runs into a gentleman who's just walking the streets of London. And he takes her home and is very concerned that she's living in this environment, and that the grandfather then goes out into the night on another errand, and then the gentleman leaves, and you meet Mr. Quilp, who is a moneylender that the grandfather is indebted to. And Quilp, for reasons that don't become clear at first, realizes that he believes that the grandfather is hoarding large sums of money. What is in fact happening is that the grandfather is gambling all this money away, ostensibly so that he can give the money to Nell later. That he's going to protect her by allowing her to live in riches when he passes away, etc., etc. And then the rest of the story involves Nell or Quilp taking over the shop because he finds out that the money's being thwarted by the grandfather. Nell and her grandfather escaping from Quilp, who wants to possess them as much as he wants to possess the shop. And the grandfather, of course, is afraid he's going to be thrown into debtor's prison and separated from Nell. And then they flee to the countryside. And the single gentleman returns to the shop, and you don't know why he's suddenly so interested in these two. But it's almost a pursuit then, a parallel pursuit by both Quilp and the single gentleman through the rest of the play. And all these characters that Nell and the grandfather meet until there's this reconciliation.
And that's what makes the play work so well is the way you guys weave in and out all is this terrific crew of zany and wacko characters that Dickens was so great at inventing. I mean, I just thought it was amazing.
Oh, well, thank you. We're having so much fun doing it, and we've been lucky so far in having fairly full houses every night, and hopefully that will continue through the run.
Well, you know, there's an audience for great entertainment like this, and I don't know of another company than Looking Glass that can take on a project like this and really make it work. I mean, this thing just flowed. It's funny. I mean, the decision to have each character, I guess, I know you play multiple characters, as most of the ensemble does, but they don't hold back. If they have a character that has one little scene and is supposed to add a little humor, boy, they really go for it.
Yes, well, and we were greatly helped in that sort of delineation by Eva Brenneman, who plays Mrs. Ginawan and Mrs. Jarley, and is also the dialect coach for the production. And because the narrative goes all over England, and Dickens doesn't specify exact place names for the towns once they get out of London, Eva was very, very helpful in terms of saying, okay, we're going to imagine that at this point Nell and the grandfather are in the south of England. At this point they probably travel to the north of England. And so she would work with each character, even if you only had four or five lines, to help get you a slightly different regional dialect, a slightly different pitch of your voice, so that hopefully, you know, the audience would feel as though they were taking that journey as well, and that even though there are only 10 of us, that there was the illusion that the stage was going to be populated by a cast of 20 or more.
Well, I can tell you that it really did work, but I was able to hear many of the well-known English accents.
Oh, good.
And the humor. I mean, this play is amazingly funny. It adds, the humor is terrific, yet it carries its point very
that's
strong.
That's great. And that's what I felt and Tracy felt as well, is that it has some of the funniest writing that Dickens ever did. It has some of the most moving writing that he ever did. But it was a fairly early novel in his career. There are things about it that, you know, it's not the strongest book overall that he ever wrote. But we both felt that it was somewhat undiscovered, and that it's something that's also rarely adapted for the stage. And that was something that I was very interested in doing, because as much as I love Dickens, I feel that, you know, there are a few books that people always see again and again and again, and it's understandable that you would see David Copperfield, Great Expectations, The Christmas Carol, of course, even Hard Times to a degree. And I thought, well, this is one that I think is going to be undiscovered for a lot of people in the audience, and hopefully the production will draw people back to the book, and it addresses things in a different way than many of his other works. And so I was very excited to to work on it with everyone at the company, and I'm just couldn't be happier that people are enjoying it.
Oh, absolutely. I didn't know the story, just a little bit. I think I'd read a synopsis of it one time or another, but I'll tell you, it definitely gets you interested in going back and reading Dickens. And because you guys brought out the rich characters and the bizarre human traits. I mean, you can go from funny to evil. I mean, Cox's character, to a certain extent, he was almost a cartoon character, and then you really see how nasty he really was.
Oh, yes. Well, and in the book, the character is, he's almost supernatural. I mean, he's actually a dwarf in the novel.
Okay.
But he's described as having the head of a giant. Dickens talks about him being bizarre and monkey-like. There's almost a suggestion that he's able to walk through walls. You get the sense that he has this almost phantom-like ability. And so even though, you know, obviously we weren't going to have an actor who's necessarily short of stature, we wanted it to be very, someone who was very protean, someone who could change in his technique, and that he would be charmingly evil, but also joyously evil, which I think Tom brings out. He speaks a different way to Nell than he will to the grandfather, than he will, and his just physicality, which was the other thing Tracy said, is that the silhouette of Quilp should be something bizarre and strange, and Tom is just extraordinary that way.
And his discipline, his physical discipline, to be able to maintain that throughout the show.
Yeah.
I mean, that's incredible.
Yeah. And then he drops it all to play Mr. Martin, who's the very kind schoolmaster that Nell and the grandfather meet.
I'll tell you how good he was in that. It took me a while to figure out who that was. Then I go, that's Cox.
Yep.
Yeah. It's incredible. Well, you play several roles, too. You're the narrator of this. You're kind of the anchor of the show.
Yes. Which is a lot of fun, and my wife is about to have our first child any day now. So some of it was conscious that I would play that role because I was going to be off stage a little more than not. But then we kept having these other little bit parts, and Tracy said, "Well, there's no one else to do it." So I end up sort of popping in here and there. But it is fun to sort of be the person to bookend the show that way in narration, to also as the narrator, to figure in as a character.
And you know, it's so great the way you guys structured it, where you come out and do that postmortem on what happens to everybody at the end. Because so many of these shows, you love the characters, and then you kind of wonder, well, geez, what happened to them?
Yes, and I love that. That's exactly the way the book ends. And that we changed very little in that text. That's almost exactly the way it is in the book. We obviously just discussed the characters that we kept for the narrative, but that's the last paragraph that I speak is the last paragraph of the novel. And I think Dickens ends the novel in a beautiful way, too, sort of with the idea that all our lives are just a story, and as long as that story is retold, that's how we stay alive. That's all we have is our memories.
How true that is. Let me ask you this from an actor's point of view. How do you and the other cast members, you go off stage, you finish the scene, you got a race to get into the next outfit or whatever you're going to do to come back on stage. How do you keep that going each night and make it fresh?
Well, the very thing that you mentioned in some regard does keep it fresh because there's no time to rest. I don't think anyone has time to go up and sit in the dressing room or take a break. We have Jennifer Edwards, who is our wardrobe master. She's there to help us get in and out of costume, and we have a running sheet. And I think also with playing so many characters, you try to get into the mindset of the next person when you come off stage. And the clothes, Mara Blumenfeld's costumes, you know, whatever you're wearing, sort of, as any actor will tell you, the way you move in that garb helps inform the character and what you do, and it's just, we all, I think, feel like we're shot out of a cannon a little bit when the play starts.
Well, I'll tell you, the stage manager has a heck of a job in this show. Huh?
Yes. Well, she's terrific.
Who is the stage manager?
Sarah Gemitter, who is our sort of our in-house Looking Glass stage manager.
You know, they don't get enough recognition for what they do in it. Of course, if the show goes the way it should, you don't even know they're there.
No. And she keeps everything running beautifully every night. She's just, you know, we've had her Thank heaven for Sarah. We've had her for years. She knows us all and keeps everyone calm and keeps everything running smoothly. And we couldn't do it without her. And she and Jonathan Templeton, who's the assistant stage manager, really run a sort of an elegant ship. So that's great.
Well, I think this is a heck of a debut directing for your director.
For Tracy.
For Tracy, yes.
She's just done such an extraordinary job, and I hope and I'm sure it will be the start of a great parallel career for her as a director. And she's worked for many years as an actor and choreographer.
Oh, yes.
And she was the assistant director to Heidi Stillman on all the productions of Hard Times. She's assisted on several other productions, and she's had such a passion for this piece in particular. She and I have worked together on it for about 3 years, and she did a lot of work in the middle stages of the script, and it's just been great for me to be able to sit back and watch her bring it to life.
One of the things that I really thought was effective is the transitions.
Yes.
On this long stage where you got to bring all these different characters and maybe a different time or trying to figure out where it is, the way she used the little transitions, a little scene with maybe one or two persons or one slowly leaving while the next thing gets going, just added so much to it because it just kept it flowing.
Right, and that's something I think we've gotten fairly good at Looking Glass. You know, that's something I think we all learned from Mary Zimmerman especially, is that the play never stops. That if you have to do any kind of scenic change, you want to have that sleight of hand where the story is still going on. And especially when you're looking at something like Dickens or a lot of the other more epic works that we adapt, there are long passages of narrative that you need to sort of elide visually so as not to take up a tremendous amount of time with text on stage. So anywhere that we felt that we could tell part of the story in the transition visually, you know, we'll go ahead and use that.
Well, I wish more directors would come see your guys' work to learn to do that. But you guys have that down to a science.
Well, yes. Well, that's good to hear. It takes a lot of work in during our technical weeks of rehearsal, and you know, that's something where everyone's input really does come to the fore and really, really does help us. And especially in this story, because there are so many times in the novel where person A doesn't know something that person B knows, and so then they have to tell person C, and I just wanted to make sure that we weren't telling the audience something they already knew. But if you see a visual interaction between two characters, and you know, okay, now Kit knows this thing that, you know, whatever it is, then that's a nice shorthand.
Yeah.
And hopefully we can do it in a beautiful and engaging way so that the play doesn't hit pause.
Well, not only where they're doing it, so you're setting up the next scene, but the way the lighting works in this really adds to it. I mean, so you guys did a lot of storytelling without words.
Well, that's great. I mean, that is our intent. So that's always gratifying to hear when we can be sure that's working the way that it's supposed to.
Well, in the interest of time now, give us a little bit of your background, because I've always said you're one of the A-list actors in Chicago. Tell us some of the shows you're most proud to have been in the last few years.
In Chicago? I did about 10 years ago, I did a season at Stratford in Canada as part of the Chicago Exchange that they have. So I was in the Young Company there, and that was a really great time. I think probably the thing I'm most known for is I was in Mary Zimmerman's original production of Metamorphoses in Chicago, and then toured that all over the country and did the original off-Broadway and Broadway productions of that show. So that was obviously a huge...
Being in a Tony Award-winning show is not a bad idea.
No.
Good career move.
So that was great, and I was in that show off and on for about 6 years, which is an extraordinary thing. Some of my favorite shows, I've done three shows now with Remy Bumpo, which is another company in Chicago, and I always love working with them. Money, particularly, which is an Edward Bulwer-Lytton play, which isn't very well known, was one of my favorites. I did Arcadia in Detroit several years ago. It was great fun. So I'm always, I think like most actors, I'm always trying to find as much variety as I can. But I've been very, very lucky, and so much of that is due to to just being in Chicago, both as a student and then as a professional actor.
So you would consider yourself more of a classical actor?
Well, I think that's where a little most of my training lies. I kind of ended up in Looking Glass by accident in some ways, even though I've been working with the company off and on for about 17 years. I ended up doing a show with them in their first season in 1989. But I was my interest was more sort of in the classical, traditional theater route. And then I went away to graduate school in the early 90s in Boston and lived in New York for a year and then was visiting Chicago for a weekend. And my great friend Phil Smith said, you know, Bruce Norris is going to be directing this adaptation of Up Against It, the Joe Orton play, for us this summer. Do you want to stay an extra day and audition? And I did, and did the show, and then kept getting called back to Chicago for various things, and eventually joined the company. But have always kept my hand in trying to do a little Shakespeare, a little Shaw, a little, you know, more traditional classical theater as well as contemporary theater elsewhere. But certainly I'm so grateful that I ended up in Looking Glass and as an ensemble member for the last 9 years. So they've really pushed me to do a lot of things that I would never have done if I had just stayed on the course that I...
It sure helps being with a group of creative souls like Looking Glass.
Yeah, it's really extraordinary now to be working with the same people for going on 20 years. And to have that shorthand with the group of actors and to have that home to come back to all the time is really something very few people...
It's got to be fun to have your name under adapted by in a major play, isn't it?
It is. It's kind of crazy because I, you know, and I'm not necessarily embarking on that as something I don't know that I'll continue to do that or not. And again, it was, you know, to have Laura and Heidi help me so greatly with that, and Tracy too, and everyone was in, you know, it's always a group effort. It's always an ensemble approach to everything that we do. But I am proud that I brought this to the table and that now it exists. Now it's out in the world and that we actually did it. And so, you know, for having some part in getting it on the stage is a very... It's a great thing. And I did have that experience. You know, I do have the experience now where I'll be watching a scene on the monitor off stage and sort of running through the various ways that the scene went textually and then forgetting that I actually have to come on stage, which is a strange but a really nice thing to hear the words that you've helped to craft to be spoken.
All right, give us a little plug now for the show. It's... The title is The Old Curiosity Shop. I love the secondary title, Victorian Fairy Tale of Joy and Woe.
Oh, great. Yes, which we think really describes it. It took us a while to come up with that, but we think that does reflect what we're doing.
All right.
So we've had a lot of kids come to the show, too.
Yeah, what's the reaction of kids? Because to me, it's about maybe 12 and up. That's what I would assume, but you said kids, what, younger than that, right?
I think a little younger.
Yeah?
I mean, I would feel comfortable, especially if, you know, the kids, you know, are, if they're familiar with the theater. I've seen kids as young as 7 or 8, and they seem to be, you know, as wrapped with it as anyone else who's enjoying it. But I don't know if the box office, I think they have a target age that they would say, you know, this may be a little too scary for someone younger than this. This might be a little, you know, it might be a little too long for someone else. But it's been surprising. I would say about 8 or 9 years old, we've had quite a few kids in that age range come to the show, and they seem to really enjoy it.
Do you do any performances for the high schools, or do you have any of that going yet?
We do. We've had one student matinee already during the weekday afternoon, and I believe that the theater is still open to doing more. It just depends on if we have any schools contact our education department, and then if we can get enough students interested, my understanding is that we could add an additional Wednesday matinee performance.
Oh, good. I hope that happens, because I know Steppenwolf and Chicago Shakespeare are doing that, and they're attracting. They're getting the kids to find out it's cool and it's okay to like theater.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And so I hope we do more for this show. And I know we're always we're always trying to bring in as many students as we can.
All right, so the show runs, what, Wednesdays?
Wednesdays through Sunday.
Sunday.
Wednesday night at 7:30, Thursday night at 6:30, Friday at 7:30, Saturday at 3 and at 8, and Sunday at 3.
I like the idea of the Thursday night at the 6:30.
Yes, that's been very popular.
Yeah, more people should do that during the week because, you know, some people say Thursday night's a tough night to get an audience. But I see the strategy here. Get them, a lot of people work downtown, and it's easy to get over to Chicago and Michigan Avenue. And that way they can get home at a decent hour.
Absolutely. Well, that's what we found, and I think we might even, I'm not sure exactly, but I think we might be doing one more evening of a 6:30 curtain starting next season, where I believe we're adding a Tuesday night as well. I think we're doing more performances per week than we have, which will be nice. But we try to balance it out to give people who want to do just as you say, get to the theater a little earlier, get home a little sooner, and certainly on Saturday night, if people are downtown and want to have a leisurely dinner first, keep the 8 o'clock curtain.
And the show runs through June 11th?
Through June 11th.
Okay, any chance of it being extended?
I think not, because our this season with the 5 shows, which is an expansion from our usual schedule, my understanding is that the show that follows us needs to get into the theater right away. So if you're interested in seeing the show, I would go ahead and buy tickets now, because I think even if we wanted to extend, my understanding is it's not likely that we would be able to.
Well, there's plenty of time for folks to get it, and I can tell you this is a tremendous show. It's totally different than most theater pieces you'd see, and it's just so well done, and you guys got to be really proud of this show.
Oh, well, thank you so much. That's so great to hear, and we are very happy with it. It's been great talking to you.
Well, thank you very much for the interview. I know you're busy, and I hope you have the wife delivers the child soon and a healthy. You've got to be excited about that, huh?
I'm very excited. I'm very excited about that. The hot, you know, we're having the baby apprentice, which is just 3 blocks from the theater. So hopefully it happened and I'm at work.
Do they have an understudy for you?
Yes. And he's been great. And he, of course, had to be ready early because there was the outside chance that, you know, we could have had the baby even in previews. So.
Wow.
But the due date is this Friday, so it could be any moment.
Oh, great. Well, thank you, Raymond, for your time, and it's been a nice interview, and keep up the great work.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello, this is Tom Williams, and you are listening to Talk Theater in Chicago's interview podcast. Our special guests today are from a show that I first discovered the playwright doing a show a couple of years ago, and they were such unique piece of theater that when I saw that Emily Schwartz has a new play out, I had to see it. And in 04, I saw The Dastardly Ficus and other comedic tales of woe and misery. And the young lady is back again with a play called Funeral Wedding, the Alvey play. And with her, we also have the star of the show, who is Matthew Holzfeind. And hello, Emily.
Hello, Tom.
Now, you got it. How do you come up with these wacky, quacky, murder mystery, comedy, something so totally different?
I write things that I find interesting, and I guess that I've always liked Edward Gorey, I've always liked Charles Adams, I like ghost stories and haunted houses and campfires and unexpected strange things in jars, and
well,
so that's kind of how I come upon.
And you don't know how refreshing it is to have a new voice. I mean, the Dastardly Ficus. Just give us a little overview of what that was about, because I thought that you had the two sisters there that were stone crazy.
Yeah, The Dastardly Ficus was basically about the Derbyshire sisters, and they lived together in their old house out in the country. And, I mean, it started off with a small play called Entertaining Mr. Tops, where one of the sisters found a severed head in the lake, and she brought it back to the house and wrapped it up like a present and wanted to marry it. And so they took off from there, and nothing was impossible after that first short little 10-minute play.
So. And it emerged to be a terrific find.
Thank you.
And then we didn't hear from you for a while. And then when Scott Drake called me, he didn't register. He said, you saw our play before. And, you know, I see. And then when he reminded me of the Dastardly Ficus, I said, oh, okay, I'm there.
Great. That's what I like to hear.
And your new play is terrific.
Thank you very much.
Now, let's say hello to the star of the play.
Oh, shucks.
Okay. And Matthew, what you did to deliver that all those early scenes in Funeral Wedding, because it's really your play, it's the Alvin play. And did she create a good character for you?
Just amazing. I don't know if it's cliche or not, but I mean, it was just so easy to do following her roadmap that she made for the character, because he's such a unique and interesting individual. And
well, tell us about Alvin.
Let's see. What should I say about Alvin? The first thing that comes to my mind when I think of him is his sensitivity, his absolute and utter sensitivity to his world and how it's been shaped and how it's kind of affected him and has made him kind of, you know, he's had experiences in his life through, you know, people outside his family and people inside his family that have kind of made him a little, you know, different than other people. And because of that, he is kind of taken that. And
well, your performance set it all up, because amazingly and nicely, you break the fourth wall by talking right to us.
Right.
And you've got 4 or 5 minutes to win us over. Mm-hmm. And you do it with a lot of charm and a lot of vulnerability and a lot of honesty. And let me ask you, Emily, if that's how you designed the character, I mean, did you realize that we had to buy him?
Yeah. Oh, immediately. Yeah. If you didn't like Alvin within the first 5 minutes, then you certainly wouldn't like the rest of the play, because it all builds on him. You have to trust him as the person to lead you through this terrible, strange story. There's a lot of information that he gives you right at first, and it's just basically that's what I wanted. I wanted you to be able to get to know the character and feel comfortable enough with this person, so that when all these weird, odd other characters come on, you have a sort of a base in
Alvin. He's really kind of neurotic, isn't he?
He's very neurotic.
Yeah, and he's got a secret.
He does have a secret, and I think that his neurosis is kind of charming, though. So he's not overwhelming.
All right, let me ask you about you have two directors.
Yes.
And you were involved in, since it's your play and this is a premiere, correct?
Yes, it is.
Tell us about how your involvement. Where the give and take? Did you pick Matthew? Did you have to
agree? It was definitely a team decision. Matt came in, and when he left the room from his first audition, we thought, he's wonderful. He's got the humor of it. He's got the sensitivity of it. And then it was the same with all the casting. It was a big discussion for him. And I think we'd set up perimeters and then narrow it down until we all came to a consensus. So.
Well, I think you made the right decision there.
I do,
but
too.
Let me ask you, too, about having the vaudevillian player. How did that work? I thought it was a nice little touch.
Yeah, I wanted something, since the characters do talk directly to the audience, I wanted a kind of like a balancing point for them, too, with that character. So he can relate to the characters on stage, and then he can be with the audience and watch. So he's sort of drifting in between the actual world and the world of the play at all times. So that's sort of why I envisioned him. And plus, for just humor, he's a funny guy.
Yes. Now, Matthew, let me ask you this. Besides conveying the emotions, you really go through the whole emotional range.
Yeah.
This is a real physical role. I mean, you're bouncing off the ground and getting thrown around and falling down. And
It's a workout. I remember the first time we ran that first act, because the first act is a little longer than the second, and it's pretty much, you know, my journey to that huge climax at the end, and I was I was on the ground like panting. It was pretty, and then you know we've kind of gotten emotionally and physically adept to it. But yeah, it's a workout.
Well, give us a little bit without giving away the main plot twist, as I did in my review. I think the show has got so many unique plot twists to kind of give it away because it's part mystery.
Yeah,
is unfair, but give us a sense of what he's going through.
Okay, the premise is basically. Alvin has locked himself in his attic for a number of years, about I would say 5 years or so, ever since a certain point in his life, and that comes to light as the play goes on, and he has developed these his little home base, I would say, is the attic, and he does certain things up there and is in his own little world, and he's very comfortable up here, but he. Is not in his right mind, of course, certainly according to the rest of the
he's
world.
He's sort of in denial of an event that happened.
Right.
And his family, right, his mm-hmm. sister and his mother and his father,
right,
are trying to get him back into the mainstream world.
Right? Mm-hmm.
So it slowly evolves. The story slowly evolves.
Right.
And I thought the characters you had playing the mother and the father. Tell us about those.
Well, it's funny because we don't use age-appropriate actors for those parts. They're young. They work. It's basically the play drifts between the past and the present and the world of Alvin in the attic and the memories that his family has of their youth and other times. So you drift back and you get to see the courting scene between his parents and you get to see his mother when she was younger and with the children and things like that. They all have strange kind of foibles.
I mean, this is the Addams Family meeting the dysfunction.
It is.
Making them look normal.
They're a little, it is. The Addams Family is a little bit kinder, I think. Less monsters.
And it's hard to develop this kind of comedy. I mean, it either works or it doesn't. And Matthew, I think you did a terrific job with it. But the interplay of all the cast, I thought it worked really well.
Everyone got the dialogue, and they picked up on the comedy right away, which is why it was so nice to work with everyone, because they got why it was funny. And the darkness of it, too. There's a serious level underneath all of it, which is why I think the comedy works.
And what I like, too, is that you leave some doubt of what happens. And I think that's good.
There's no clear end. You just sort of have to roll with it or make up your own mind as to what happens. It's kind of a mystery.
Now, I've got a couple of... Let me ask Matthew a couple of questions. This was kind of debatable, but one of my friends was trying to figure out the relationship of you with the doctor.
Yes.
And with... I mean... I got it that the doctors kind of went after your character and your sister.
Mm.
Would you consider that valid?
Yes, for sure. Robert Elliott, the doctor, played by Les Cruz, was basically a family, a friend. And in the beginning, I had a great relationship with Alvin and a great relationship with everybody. But it has kind of turned sour, at least according to Alvin's point of view. But yes, has gone to courting his sister, which of course makes Alvin livid, and which is another great thing.
I mean, Emily, what kind of mind must you have to come up with these characters? I mean,
they're kind of horrible, aren't they?
Well, but he's a delicious villain. The
isn't
doctor.
He wonderful?
Yes.
I love him.
Yeah,
he's terrifying in every way, but he's so much fun to watch. At least for me, I love him.
And the cat, I mean, he's got that look of a villain.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you dressed him perfect.
Great.
Now, I guess that the era had to be 20th century, even though it's very much of a Gothic Victorian story. But then when you mentioned cars and all that, so I'm guessing like pre-World War I or maybe 1920s?
The thing is, with the time, it's all an imaginary time. It's kind of like with Ficus before, where I like to set things up in a world where you can recognize that it's the past. It is, it's a time period from the past, but it's for sure an imaginary place. It's an odd world that sort of floats about.
I love the treatment of having the two young girls coming under the bed and haunting. That was a nice touch.
The ghosts. I think they're pretty scary.
Yeah, the first time. I mean, Matthew jumped almost out of his... the first time. That was a nice touch. What made you use the rhyme in Act 2?
Well, the rhyme actually came out of sheer frustration for me and the play. And when I was writing it, in the process of writing it, I hit a point where I knew where I wanted to go, I just didn't know how to get there. And I knew the level of fun that I wanted to have with it, but I really didn't know what to do. And so it was about 3 o'clock in the morning one night, and I thought, you know what, play? You don't want to cooperate with me, I'm just going to make you rhyme. And so I started writing the rhyme scene as a joke to myself, and then I realized, I was like, I really like rhyme scene.
And then having is Anne her name?
Yes.
And Anne. Having her answer him in rhyme.
Yeah.
Work.
It's, I think it's the only way that it could make, you know, that it would roll along with itself. So.
Well, how is the show being received so far?
Really well. Yeah. It's going really well. I have been nothing but pleased with the response that we've gotten, and just meeting up with people after the show. And since we've only really had one Monday press preview so far, and this Thursday, you know, tonight, Thursday, is the official opening of the show. So,
well, that's great. Then,
yeah.
When this will people be hearing this next week, so you'll had a few shows under your belt.
Great. You should come out. It's great.
Well, Matthew, let's get back to you now. What is your background? I'm trying to remember where I saw you. You did a couple plays for Eclipse Theater.
I did. Right. I did, yes.
What's your background a little bit?
As far as, like, I've been in town or so?
Yeah.
I've been in town about three and a half years. And
From?
From, well, graduated from Indiana University, was born in Dallas, Texas. Kind of came up here and worked a lot with the Looking Glass Theater. They gave me a couple good early shots as an understudy, and then worked at Eclipse, great theater. Was in two of their shows last year, and just finished up a new musical at Chicago Jewish Theater. And
which one were you in?
The Feathers in the Wind. It's neat. It's always great. It's the third time actually I've worked on a new play. The first time I did it was a musical called Camp Nimrod for Girls. And there's always something cool about working about a new play, but the unknowns multiply, of course, when you're working on a new musical, which, you know, because you've got the new
but movie. What's great about it, if you really land it, you can kind of put a mark on it, which makes it really hard for them to cast anyone but you.
Right.
That's and
the right of first refusal, Ms. Schwartz.
That's the well, that's what they all try and do in New York. You know, they
right.
try and put their stamp on it, and, mm-hmm. and that's legitimate.
Right.
How did you get involved with this group?
Well, known Emily for quite a while. We weathered hurricanes last summer together, and so we go back.
Oh, okay.
I knew I wanted to be a part of this production even before I read it, only because I knew I just wanted to work with her and work with all of my good friends. But once I read the show, it was. And I realized how really great and, you know, and different
yeah.
it is. It's so refreshing.
But it's a tough role for you. I mean,
it is. And I was nervous. I was nervous because I knew I wanted it to be good for her. I knew everyone. See, the thing is, we all went into this rehearsal process. Everyone in that room, with the most, you know, absolute optimism and, like, really wanting this to be a really amazing experience and believing that it could be. So there was a lot of high hopes, and I think with that came a lot of you know. Maybe a little stress that, you know, that to make it that which, you know, hopefully it has become. But yeah, I mean, I wanted to work, you know, with Emily and the show for a while. So I was glad that she, you know, blessed me with this role.
So Emily, was he your first choice? How did that work?
Yeah, actually he was. Once there were a lot of good people that came in to read for auditions, but once we saw Matt, and we saw you earlier. Early on, because you had some kind of conflicts, we saw you were one of the first people that we saw, and he just stuck with me. And it's funny because Matt, when I was writing the show in my head, I had always thought of the character as shorter, darker hair, little glasses, and Matt.
Oh no, he's got the and it's part of it. But I love the thing you talk about weight, and I mean he's tall and thin. And
you're
what,
a beanpole, Matt.
What 6'1"? About what
6'4"?
6'4", not short at all, Matt.
Not short at all, yeah.
But he captured everything that I wanted in the character, and I could see the potential of that first read was amazing, and the work that he's done in the show is outstanding, and it's different every night to watch Matt react to certain situations. The play has a life of its own, which makes it so exciting for me. I mean, gosh knows I've seen it at least 100 times already. And I mean, I enjoy watching the performers in the show have fun. And
well, that's unique because, you know, there's a lot of playwrights that can't see their show, or they see one, they don't want to go near it again.
I love the show. Makes me happy.
Well, that's good. Let me ask you this. Now, what are some of the other plays that you've done?
I've worked a lot. Like I said, Ficus has been around the Interact Theater in Los Angeles, did it last year. It's done a couple of festivals. My play, The Handheld Saint, won the Metropolis Performing Arts New Play Contest last year. And then I've done a lot of work. I did Collaboration Sketchbook 5 last year. I'm going to do Sketchbook 6 again this year with everybody. That was nice. Estrogen Fest. I've worked with Boxer Rebellion and Side Projects. So I spent a lot of time in between the larger play working on festivals and working on smaller pieces and getting to know people and hopefully getting my work seen around town, because I'd love to keep working in Chicago. So.
Have you ever presented any of your plays to, like, Chicago dramatists or Russ Tutterow?
Not yet. I
he'd be a good man. I think he'd like your work.
Well, I'll have to pass it along then.
Send him an email. Invite him to the show.
I will. Yeah. Indeed.
But tell us how the rest of the casting went, because I thought it was a pretty strong cast. And generally when, you know, new theater companies, storefront shows, usually there are one or two good people and it gets a little thin.
Yeah. Well, I'm very fortunate to know so many talented actors. And in the process of writing the play, I had several readings of the play. And a lot of the actors, and basically all the actresses that were at the readings, time after time after time, ended up getting cast in the show just because they had seen these characters develop. They had developed these parts. They had read it time and time again. And as well as the actors in the show, they'd done readings. And basically everyone... we picked the cast because they worked so well together as a unit. And I don't want to put somebody up on stage that I'm not completely proud of. I'm completely proud of everyone in this show. So I think they're rock solid.
Well, Matthew, I got to ask you, I thought you had an excellent chemistry with the young lady who played Anne.
Carol Enoch. Yeah.
Carol Enoch, right?
Yes.
I thought she was strong in that.
She, isn't she?
Yeah, yeah. How do you prepare when you have to put so much of your energy out early in the show, because I think you set the tone.
It's a big jump, especially, you know, because you start out, you know, talking directly to the audience, and you do have to, I mean, give them a cause to like you. And and luckily the last show I did with Eclipse, the Italian son, I had my same thing. I walked right out to the audience and spoke a huge monologue to him. And I think there's something to the effect when you break that fourth wall immediately, you do have to you know, give a case for yourself so they'll be with you. Otherwise, they might get turned off.
And you have to be vulnerable. And I think you did that a lot, and people could feel it.
Yeah,
it works in the small theater doing that. And I think it's a testimony to you putting your stamp on the show, and to I think some pretty darn good writing and some good staging. Who did the sets? I mean, the set was terrific.
Oh yeah,
too.
Tell them about Chris.
The set is done by Chris Stengrevics, and he's new to Chicago by way of New York. Wonderful, and he was wonderful to work with. He came in. We were talking to a couple different people for set design, and we had a few really good, solid options. And there was this one new guy who wanted to come in and make a case for why he should do the set. And he basically brought in the world with him. He had the drawing and a model. And his set was pretty much what I had envisioned in my head just from the initial drawing. And so I knew that it was him. And he's... fantastic.
I mean, it looks like an attic. And then over in the corner, they have this big tree.
The tree.
And at first, I couldn't figure out what the tree, but then I saw how you used the tree to actually create another scene and to let people come in and out. And I thought that worked rather well.
Thanks. Yeah, he didn't really know how to make the tree at first. That was one of our dilemmas. He's like, I've never made a tree, but it will happen. That's what I liked about Chris. He's like, don't worry about it. It'll happen. And then there was a tree.
Well, too many times in small budget productions, the set is overlooked.
Right.
And but you guys did a nice job on
it's
this.
The world. Yeah. It's I want people to be able to come into the space and enjoy it right away before the actors get on stage. I want there to be a plethora of things to look at. I think that he did.
Plus, Matthew, you're actually on stage before the show starts.
Yeah. Well, the conceit, and this isn't giving anything away. The conceit of it is that the audience has been invited by Alvin to his attic so he can talk because you know he. It's a little weird that he's been up in his attic for so long, and the people that he's talked to, the professional people, have told him that it is quite all right to talk to people. Maybe the fact that if he does, then it will maybe help him out. So these are his guests. So you're walking, when you walk into the theater, you're walking into his room, and we've tried to make that as comfortable as possible.
Yeah, and that comes across. It doesn't take too long before you start seeing it. And I love that everybody that makes an entrance reacts to the audience. So that... That's a nice little touch. So if they don't get it the first time, by about the second or third person that comes in, then they're starting to get it.
Right.
And that's, you know, to be able to maintain that is hard. And I think audiences really like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the fourth wall is an old myth. So it was a good decision to do that.
Yeah, the one thing I like about Emily's work is that it really is highly dramatic and like it really is highly theatrical. And you couldn't do this there's so many players that try to write screenplays these days. You know, it's like, what are you trying to do? And like, she writes for the theater, and that's what's so good about this show. It's like you couldn't do this as a movie. This is a theater. This is an audience.
Well, you
relationship.
Know how you're right about that, and how we hate these scripts that are really screenplays, and they have 20 blackouts, you know, the 30-second scene and the 20-second black where they move the furniture. That is so annoying.
Yeah.
And it is purely a play.
It is.
And
it's
that's
just
what
so
makes
great.
It work. Yeah. That's what
it's
makes
kind
it
of a play that knows it's a play. So
yeah. And
that's
poking
kind of
fun amazing. At itself.
Yeah. That's what I love. I love making theater. And I think that this is exactly what it is. You come in, come to enjoy it. It's not uncomfortable. There's no weird audience participation. You're just, you know, it's just you're involved and you're in a space. It's an atmosphere. It's an environment. It's fun.
You can also
to come
bring.
Out.
You can also have younger people. How young do you think could handle the show?
Well, it's going to be a choice, a parental choice, because there's nothing. I mean, there's violent aspects to it, but it's not. It's hard to say. It's a violent story told in rhyme. So if you
And
if
it's
you
got
like
that macabre humor and
it's a
hybrid, yeah.
It is. It's kind of like if you like Grimm's fairy tales, sort of. You know, if you
so
don't mind
12, 13
the ghosts of little girls.
Yeah.
You know, it's 12, 13. I think that it would be good for that age group. But there's nothing.
And it's got no bad language in it.
No.
You know, I'm so tired of that. And usually that's a sign of a lazy playwright.
Yeah.
You know, Mamet and Albie can make it work maybe, but some of the rest of them, they have their quota of cuss words in a show, and it's just nice to see a show.
I think you can get your point across with, you know, in a much more interesting way sometimes. You know, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. In the show, it wouldn't have fit in at all. So, but the language, reading it over and over again and making a specific choice to have it accessible at least to everyone. So hopefully it won't offend the ear.
Matthew, you have some really funny stuff going on there.
Yes, well, I don't know about cuss words, but I do say ignorant sodhead, so.
Well, we'll let you do that. So what's the future going to be for you now? What do you
For me?
Yeah.
Nothing on the horizon as of yet.
I got a feeling, though, that this show is going to help you quite a bit, because people who don't know who you are, they come see the show, they'll know.
Well, I'm flattered, Tom. That's
nice
of you.
No, I mean, really.
This is Chicago theater. I mean, that's why I'm here, and that's why we're here, and that's why, you know, I want to stay as long as I can, because, I mean, opportunities like this just don't happen.
And
everywhere.
They're not happening in New York. They're not happening in Toronto anymore. As Chris Jones has pointed out in several articles, it's happening here.
Mm-hmm.
And, boy, I believe, you know, I totally believe that.
All right.
So are you planning on getting this published and getting it around so other people can do this show around the country?
That's my long-term plan.
Okay.
Yeah. I know that with Interact in LA, when they did Ficus, some of the girls from that are coming to see this show. They did a reading of Funeral Wedding out there already. So they might hopefully put it on in Los Angeles. But my main goal is to get it published and eventually spread it around. And
well, you keep it going, and that'll happen. All right, let's give a little promo for the show, where it's at, Number to call and what days you're showing?
Oh, that is at the Athenaeum Theater Studio 2, 2936 North Southport. Second floor studio, yeah. You can call Ticketmaster for tickets or come straight to the box office. We have Industry on Thursday and Sunday for $12, and that's senior discount too. And then regular tickets are $15.
Which is quite a bargain.
Yeah,
I mean, it really is.
We wanted to keep it low. We discussed ticket prices, and I want to keep it within reach so that we can get as many people in here to see it as possible because there's some great work going on.
And it runs through when?
It runs through the 17th of June, so...
Any chance for an extension?
There might be. Hopefully, we'll need one, but I can't say as of yet.
Okay. So the show is Funeral Wedding, The Alvin Play.
The Alvin Play.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Tom.
This is Tom Williams, and go see a play this week.
Well, thank you very much for listening to this enrapturing episode of Talk Theater in Chicago, the podcast, brought to you by TalkTheaterInChicago.com. But before I let you go, it's time for your Shakespeare Quote of the Week. The following quote has to do with delays, and it comes from Henry VI, Part 1, Act 3, Scene 2. Delays have dangerous ends. Well, I can't thank you enough for listening to Talk Theater in Chicago, the podcast. Remember, we have a new podcast ready for your ears every Monday. So don't forget to come on back to TalkTheaterInChicago.com and check it out. Until then, I am your host, Dustin Moat, reminding you that theater's happening. Don't miss it.